morning, everyone. I'm David Mandel, and it is a privilege to be here this morning and to thank Rabbi David and Mrs. Anita Fuller for sponsoring today's conference. Also to thank Jennifer Proud and Adiel Monk, co-presidents, for organizing what is really a very special day. A lot has been mentioned about Shidduchim this morning, which is especially relevant, and I would add a comment to what Rabbi Fuller said and what was discussed on the eating disorder session, that much more attention has to be paid that young women are at a disadvantage than young men when they face these life challenges, and too many more questions are asked about the young woman than about the young men. And that is simply not necessary, not right, and is also an issue that needs to be addressed by paying less attention to asking so many questions. Amar Rav Lechia Bria. Rav said to his son Chia, in Masechtas Pesachim, in the tractate Pesachim, Rav spoke to his son Chia, and he said to him, and he implored him, "I'll teach this son, don't drink drugs. It seems that it is well known that drugs can be taken in many forms. And this is a conversation that took place 1,500 years ago. Rashi explains that Rav said to his son that if you consume drugs, it'll be bad for your heart. 3,010 years ago, Kohelas, Shlomo HaMelech wrote, Moshe Hayyia, what was, will be. Ein Chadash Tachas HaShemesh. There is nothing new beneath the sun. What was discussed, what did happen, will happen again. Max Weber, 100 years ago, postulated that the single most important characteristic for leaders is charisma. If one has charisma, one attains the single greatest characteristic to be a leader. It is debatable, that's what Max Weber postulated. Dr. Abraham Twersky postulated, and it is following a conversation that occurred this morning on the eating disorder session, that self-esteem may be a single greatest attribute and characteristic. I heard Rabbi Twersky say 10 years ago, in an answer to a question, how did you write several dozen books? And Dr. Twersky's response was, I really only wrote on one issue. I only wrote on the issue of self-esteem. I just wrote it 40 different times in 40 different ways. So if charisma is to leadership, then self-esteem may be to an individual. That's the connection that I see between organizations like YU, which focus on leadership, and the Medical Ethics Society, and the individual that we're focusing on today. In this session this morning on addictions and substance abuse, participants will walk away, as all of us have read, without my having to repeat anything, with a well-rounded understanding of halachic and ethical considerations that govern these issues of mental health. Ethics involved in treating the patient when the therapist knows of a better suited clinician for the person. Of all the issues that were discussed in the summary, that stood out to me. Because that deals with the issue of halacha. That deals with the issue of morality. That deals with the issue of finances. And the closing three words also struck me. That how can we take to lower the number of teens at risk? Now we know that teens cover the ages of 13 to 19. Many of us working with adolescence and these issues, recognize that adolescents may go into their 20s and into their 30s and sometimes into their 40s. So it's not just the adolescents that we're speaking about. Young people have issues that go into 20s, 30s, and 40s, and once again, we may be blaming some of the adolescents when some of the young people beyond adolescents also have these issues that all of us in this room are paying attention to. Three distinguished panelists. Let's begin with Dr. Tricia Tia. Dr. Tia's 30 years experience in behavioral health care. Currently, Dr. Tia is in full-time practice in New York City with a specialty working with clients with co-occurring disorders and survivors of sexual abuse. Dr. Tia has been an adjunct professor at Yeshiva University and New York University and a guest speaker at conferences and seminars in the United States, Canada, Israel, and a nationally published author. Dr. Tia co-authored two articles, Short-Term Treatment of Substance Abuse, in Clients and Women's Addiction, and Treatment Through an Historical Lens. It's my pleasure, my privilege to introduce Dr. Tricia Tia.
Hi, everybody. I'm not going to be talking about Shidduchim. Sorry about that. To prepare for this, I decided that I would talk to colleagues and think about ethics as I went through my practice every day. Unsurprisingly, the issue of ethics came up every day, almost with every patient. I want to give you two quotes, though, from clients. As clients came in, I would, in between maybe be looking at a book on ethics. And I want to tell you what two clients said about ethics in terms of substance abuse. One client tried to convince me that using OxyContin was more ethical than using marijuana. Why, I said, is that more ethical? Because it's prescribed by a doctor. The second client tried to convince me that he only used natural substances. Natural? Yes. Poppy, things from a poppy, like all the opiates, would be considered natural. So would marijuana. But he would never use oxys because ethically it's against his principles. This, obviously, in working with addicts, as we know, is part of the entire denial system. But it did make me think about the concept of ethics and why do we have ethics and what is the purpose of ethics. Professionals have an ethical code because difficult decisions need to be made all the time. And the code is to provide a clear account of what behavior is considered ethical or correct or right in a certain set of circumstances. Ethics then provide a written description of principles, of values, standards, and rules of behavior that should guide our decisions, our procedures, so that we operate in a professional and ethical way that will enhance the welfare of our clients and everyone else that we come into contact with. When I first thought about doing this speech, I decided to look at the first book that I ever bought as I moved towards orthodoxy myself. And that book was Perkei Avot by Rabbi Abraham Twersky. When I looked at it, I noticed that unlike all the other books, which have the translation Perkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers, Rabbi Twersky's book was called Visions of Our Fathers. And I wanted to ask him if he could let us know why. Rabbi Twersky? I prepared him.
I had to choose a title for the book. Ethics of the Fathers is the name of Pirkei Avos, right? That is the name of the volume. I couldn't write Ethics of the Fathers unless I would say Commentary on Ethics of the Fathers, and that was too cumbersome. So, simply for a very practical reason, we gave it another name, Vision of the Fathers.
Okay, so I also took a look at the book very carefully and realized it was far too big of a nut to crack to use that for this presentation. So I resorted to some more mundane codes of ethics, that from the National Association of Social Work, the American Psychological Association, and CASAC, which is a certification for alcohol and substance abuse counselors for New York. I was going to also download the ethics from the American Psychiatric Association. However, although all the others were free, this one I would have had to pay $60 for, and so you're going to be without that today. One of the interesting things that I noticed in looking at the NASW Code of Ethics, which as a social worker I really tried to adhere to and subscribe to and learned a lot about as I was preparing for this, there was an interesting 2008 change. It says social workers should avoid unwarranted negative criticism of colleagues in communication with other clients or professionals. I think this is the Lashon Hara edition. There are many, many things that all of the codes seem to agree with, and we're not going to sit here and elucidate every one. Some of them I think are pretty standard and really don't have a lot of difficulty with. Things like confidentiality, record keeping, sexual relationships. None of the codes of ethics think we should be having sex with our clients. Acknowledgement of conflict between ethics and sometimes between ethics and law. We're not to discriminate. We're not to promote. And we are to prepare for our own demise. Have all of you done that? I know I haven't. We really are, according to the ethics, supposed to be thinking about if something happens to us, who's going to get the records? How is this going to be taken care of? Again, on the Lashon Hara, there is a section on derogatory language about clients. And I remember years ago sitting in a treatment team meeting, and there was a mental health professional there, and she kept referring to clients as those axis twos. And she had that, like, I just sucked a lemon expression on her face. Those axis twos. She was at the head of the food chain in terms of the treatment team. And I thought to myself, you know, not only is she being so derogatory about the client, but she's really sending a message to the entire treatment team. How are these younger professionals, professionals with less, technically lower degrees, supposed to approach clients in an unbiased and objective manner when she kept referring to these people as those axis twos? Obviously, Lashon Hara is something we all struggle with, and I think the impact in clinical settings when we talk about clients is really very serious. One other very interesting thing that I would not have thought of was we're not supposed to barter. So that client that asked me to exchange fabulous jewelry for treatment, I'm going to have to say no to. Apparently, and this was again in all of the ethical codes, it leads to exploitation and crossing of inappropriate boundaries. I think that very few of us have chosen a profession based on the code of ethics. How many people here, for example, in deciding to become a social worker or a psychologist or to get their KSEC, how many people here said, oh, let me check out the code of ethics before going into that profession? Okay, so that'd be none? Right, I didn't either. But really, I think we should. For example, in the National Association Social Worker Code of Ethics, there is an emphasis on the interest of the client being primary. the concept of self-determination. Our interactions with potential clients is predicated on pursuit of their interests and an understanding of their beliefs, priority, and goals, whether or not it corresponds to ours. It is imperative that we are aware of our own biases when thinking about matters of religion and spirituality. That's straight from the code. So that they're recognizing that there is potentially a conflict between your own sense of religion and spirituality and where the client is coming from. Interestingly and unfortunately, a client can't be hospitalized against their will for using massive amounts of drugs. Now you could say, but it looks like they're on a suicidal path, right? We all know that what they're using can kill them. But in this state and in other states where I've worked, the concept of suicidality that would mandate hospitalization is defined so narrowly that literally the person has to practically have the noose around their neck in order to be hospitalized. That's the law, but I don't think it's ethical. I want to address a few specific areas. Practicing within your area of competence, conflicts of interest, physical relationships with clients, payment for services, interdisciplinary collaboration and consultation, always keeping in mind, is this in the best interest of the client? Any kind of ethical code, or even the DSM-4 or soon to be 5, always assumes you are going to use your best judgment. Codes and books can't legislate good sense. So let's look at competence. We are supposed to be competent in the area with which we are going to treat the client. Dr. Mendel noted that I had said, what if you know of a better therapist? I had put that in the introduction. So that's an interesting ethical question. Let's say you're a new social worker or a new psychologist. Of course there are going to be, quote, better therapists out there if education and length of time doing the work is going to determine what is a better therapist, right? So it's really not so easy, because then what, we have no new therapists ever? Okay, I think there are two really important ways that we can address this. I think early on in somebody's career, they should probably, my view, be working with an interdisciplinary team and not on their own. I think that's the ethical way to practice. And I think to ensure competence, everybody should be in supervision, no matter how long you've been practicing. Examples might be, should one work with somebody who is a drug addict, who is using excessive amounts of alcohol, if they don't have training in addiction? What if they've never gotten their CASAC or their CADAC? In different states, they're called different things. What if they went to a conference and heard a one-hour presentation on addiction? Is that enough? At what point do you feel you know enough? That's your ethical decision to make, and that's a decision that hopefully we're all confronted with each time we are asked to treat a client. I have noticed that people who do not receive supervision have two significant problems. One is that, this is on the minimal end, they don't grow. And so when I referred somebody to them 20 years ago, they had the same case conceptualization as they have today, because they haven't grown. And interestingly enough, the people who generally don't go to supervision also don't go to conferences. Not 100% of the time, but there seems to be a high overlap. Somebody else can do that for their, I don't know, dissertation. On the more severe end, if you don't go to supervision, I think some of your own issues, I know that some of your own issues get involved. Now, I am a supervision junkie. I have weekly individual supervision. I have bi-monthly group supervision for EMDR, and soon I'm going to be having supervision because I'm going for a new certification, God willing, in emotionally focused therapy for couples. I never feel that it's too much, and I always learn from my supervisors, and I believe that my clients, which in the end is the goal, are enhanced because of that. So I want to give you an example. I started to supervise a clinician because his rabbi mandated him to get supervision. So that was very interesting. His rabbi had been sending clients to him for a long time, and his rabbi noted that each time he worked with somebody, the case blew up. Here's what I mean by blew up is there were crises and problems, and you know, somebody was calling the police or somebody was doing so. Each case that he sent in, even though many times there was a very positive outcome in the end, each case blew up in its own way. So I started to work with him. And what I found out in terms of his own background and in terms of his own work is that it was sort of an adrenaline junkie. He kind of himself had an issue where he thrived on the thrill of what would happen. He loved, on some level, being home and getting crisis call after crisis call in those 2 hours before Shabbos. He loved that people assumed this meant he was really important. He wasn't in touch with any of those issues because he had never been in supervision before. I have no idea if he harmed clients or, you know, I don't want to go that far. But to me, literally, to practice without supervision, I believe is unethical. Now, that's my decision, and I no longer refer to people who don't receive supervision. What about new techniques? If you are a competent therapist in a particular field, from an ethical perspective, it is incumbent upon you to make sure you are up to date with the latest things, the latest advances in the field that you are alleging to be an expert in. I was wondering recently if I needed to learn EMDR. Because I work with survivors of incest and sexual abuse. Very interesting story about my own humility and EMDR. About 20 years ago, we set up a trauma unit at Hollywood Hospital, and EMDR was sort of just peeking up on the horizon. And it looked like a bunch of hocus pocus to me. And so as the director, I was like, well, we're not getting trained in that. So that's really bizarre. So today, for people who know, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy is really a cornerstone. And most of the great people who work and who have studied survivors and worked with them over the last 20 to 25 years are all recommending it and all using it. I did go for training in EMDR, and I did begin, and I am in the process of getting certified because I believe that is the ethical and responsible thing to do. If somebody is working with children, something that I don't do, and they don't know anything about play therapy, they don't know how to look at drawings and understand what the nonverbal communications of children mean, I think that's unethical. And this is all in the area of competence. Next topic. Multiple or dual relationships. First of all, they exist all the time. If I see somebody here at this conference, and I also treat a family member, then to a certain extent, that's a dual relationship. The most common one that comes up for me in terms of a dual relationship is that a lot of therapists either see me or more commonly send their relatives to me. And I doubt I'm alone in this. You know, if you've got somebody that's a friend or a colleague and they think that you're good at what they do, what you do, why would they send to somebody that they don't know and they don't trust? But that inherently is a dual relationship. The social worker or the clinician bears the ethical responsibility to always make clear which role and which relationship they have with the client and uphold the ethical obligations of that designated role. Okay? A common one that comes up in my supervision group, I supervise some young clinicians. Maybe that's a way that I'm fulfilling the ethical responsibility to take care of my clients when I meet my demise, because they're all a lot younger. And in that group, there are three young clinicians who are also rabbis. And one of the things that they struggle with and that the clients that they work with struggle with is, what role are you in? From an ethical perspective, you don't have to you have to decide and let your client know what capacity you are functioning in. I have a client that's in a situation where he's working with a rabbi who is also a certified life coach. Now, in his role as life coach, he's helping this client work toward getting into school and developing vocational skills and developing social skills. So when he turns around and tells him that he should be putting tefillin on in the morning, and he shouldn't be associating with non-Jews when he goes to college, the client is angry and confused. Okay, he's switching roles. I don't think he's clear with what is his role. The problem with dual relationships is that they are confusing to clients. They can potentially take advantage of clients. Another interesting thing that came up this week in terms of my own practice and dual relationships, although on a much more subtle concept, and usually the ethical issues are more subtle than we struggle with. They're not obviously blatant. They're not things like, I'm going to break confidentiality by calling a newspaper and letting them know what client I'm seeing. They're usually much more subtle. So this is a client who is also a clinician, and she said, I just wanted to give you this number. And she handed me a phone number, and she said, that person works in XYZ clinic, and if you ever have clients with insurance, you could send to her. And so without thinking, I said, oh, thank you so much. And then she said, and feel free to use my name because I'd like to help you if you need to get somebody into that clinic. And suddenly I felt that I was on quicksand. Suddenly just accepting this number seemed like, okay, so now what's my relationship with the client? She's now helping me. I'm not just helping her, and now I'm supposed to use her name and say, so I handed back the number and I said, thank you very much. Obviously, that became the topic for the rest of the, you know, conversation. Yes, this was a client with some boundary issues. The key piece here in looking at dual relationships, in looking at conflicts of interest, is where there is harm to the patient. So, if you are attending a simcha of the client's family, you want to be careful about confidentiality. Like I'll often say to a client, you really want me to come? You really want me to come? How are you going to introduce me? Often they really want me to come, they really want me to come, but they haven't thought that through. Okay? But assuming that there isn't a confidentiality issue, because I have clients who will say, this is my therapist, isn't she great? But assuming there isn't a confidentiality issue, you're really looking at harm to the patient. That can always be the concept that kind of trickles through all of these issues. I had an interesting example of this in the topic that I was mentioning before, where a rabbi that I know well and have worked with for about 15 years, as long as I'm working with the ultra-Orthodox community, sent me his daughter to work with. And of course, she and I talked about it a lot. I really wasn't so sure I should accept the referral. She really insisted. One of the problems I sometimes run into is rabbi referrals are hard to turn down, at least for me, because it's the rabbi. And so treatment progressed, Baruch Hashem, pretty well. She is no longer addicted, and she had a pretty serious drug addiction. She was able to move on in her life in many different issues. And then came the one issue that she had never told anybody, which was a somewhat sexual relationship that she had had with her brother. By the way, this came up 3 years into treatment. And she kept saying, you know, I just don't feel ready to discuss this issue. And yet she could delineate the ways that it was getting in the way of her life. Finally, I said to her, do you think because of my relationship with your father, you're not feeling comfortable? And she just exploded. And she said, he knew about this. And although he did something about it, he never talked about it and pretended after that that it never existed. I think that's what you would do too. At that point, I made a referral, and Baruch Hashem, I hear where she's engaged. So it really was a significant, significant block. And 3 years later, the issue came up that had not been an issue. So we've got to keep all of these things so much at the forefront of our minds. Another few things, obviously we wouldn't have sexual relationships with clients, but I would want to say something about physical contact in general. I believe the statistics are something like 80 to 85% of clients who come into treatment for addiction or mental health have some sort of abuse in their history. If that's true, then I think that we don't know how they are perceiving that hug or that pat on the back. I think it is potentially a dangerous thing to have any physical contact with clients, and this has nothing to do with religious issues. This is straight clinical. Consultation and collaboration. If you don't collaborate with other people who are seeing your client, it's unethical. It doesn't matter how busy you are. You will pull the client apart instead of putting them back together. Collaboration is an ethic. It is a demand. How about no remuneration? This is a great one. I had I haven't come across in private practice often this issue, but I want to tell you, years ago when I opened up a hospital in Texas, I had, you know, people just offering me direct. You know, you pay me $200 per client, I'll send you clients. Straight out, over lunch, no embarrassment. After all, it's Texas. But more recently, I was asked to go, we'd love to fly you down to Florida. We are opening up a new treatment program, and we heard that you are only willing to refer clients to treatment programs that you've seen. That's true. I am only willing to refer to treatment programs that I've seen. But I thought, you know, well, it doesn't feel totally ethical to me. I think that maybe this could, at least, maybe I'd feel more pulled to send there if I had gotten a free trip. It was a little harder when a program in Israel offered the same thing. But I resisted anyway. The last thing that I'll say is misrepresentation. Make sure your credentials are clear. If you ever see them on a flyer with the wrong credentials, you have to correct them. That's happened to me fairly often. And I did come up, and this will be my final comment. I was trying to think of what is the most unethical thing that I can think of, broad-based, that has influenced this field in the last 20, 25 years. And it's managed care. Thank you.
Confidentiality, self-determination, supervision, stay current. That's the advice, that's the recommendation Dr. Tia spoke about, and she referenced often Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos also says a Selech Avav. Get yourself a mentor. Part of supervision, part of training, part of learning. You can never stop learning. And certainly, Dr. David Pelkovitz, who so many of you know, at this university, has been one of my mentors and someone that I've learned so much from over the years. You know him as the Gwendolyn and Joseph Sprouse Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at the Azrieli School of Jewish Education Administration here. He's Special Assistant to President Richard Joel. Dr. Pelkovitz is an instructor in pastoral counseling at the Rabbi Isaac Ochanan Theological Seminary. We know Dr. Pelkovitz is someone that has not only been an expert on so many issues throughout the Jewish community, he has transcended that and become an expert around the world on issues of trauma, many other areas having to do with children, adolescents, trauma, and loss. He's particularly proud of publishing a book with his father, Rabbi Rafael Pelkovitz, Balanced Parenting. And it is a milestone in someone's life to be able to publish a book together with one's father, who is his rav, who is his mentor, Dr. David Pelkovitz.
Figured out if I'm going to use slides or not use slides. We'll put one slide up and we'll see if that's enough. Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to be part of a such a wonderful panel. Thank you to Bill and Jenny for your incredible patience. I'm amazed at how persistent and patient and wise they were in putting together this wonderful conference. And thank you to the Fold family for also for your generous support. I'm gonna spend hopefully the next 20 minutes bouncing off of some of the underpinnings of ethics. Trish did a wonderful job of talking about some of the broad stroke issues in terms of professional ethics. And I was thinking that rather than speak about specific questions, which we're going to hear about from Rabbi Dr. Fursky, I just want to talk about, you know, the whole idea is that moral knowledge, ethical knowledge, does not translate to ethical action. We all know that. We all know people who are incredible talmidei chachamim, incredible masters of everything that there seems to be to know about Jewish ethics and Jewish law, and yet their menschlichkeit, their ability to carry that into day-to-day life isn't necessarily what makes the most sense. So I'm going to bounce off of three or four core guidelines in the literature about what is it that we know serves as a prevention against substance abuse with us as parents and with us as educators. Now, I don't think I'm going to say anything that's all that surprising, but I think it requires review. In a conference on ethics in this area, we should talk about what is it that as parents, as grandparents, we need to know about in terms of protecting our children or grandchildren or beyond from risk for substance abuse. And what is it that as educators we need to know in terms of partnering with families on this? And let me start, see what happened to that slide. Okay, I lost it. I'll take that as a sign that I should do this without my slides. That's fine. Slides. So I'm gonna bounce off of what we know about risk factors, and I'm going to start about something very wise I once heard from the head of NIDA, of the National Institute for Drug Abuse, that the federal government funds conducting really cutting-edge research. And he said in a talk that I heard at North Shore Hospital once, that adolescents are drawn to drugs, when you pull it together, either to feel good or to feel better. There's a subset that are drawn to substances because they're thrill seekers, as many adolescents are. They want to try the newest thing. They want to try something that's going to give them the next high, and they'll do anything in order to get to that altered state of consciousness. So they're doing it to feel good. And that's what adolescents do for a living sometimes. And that's one subset. Another subset are kids who do it to feel better. They're self-medicating an underlying depression. Some research shows that on average it takes between two to four years or beyond. We have experts in this audience far greater than any knowledge I have about the connection between an underlying depressive disorder in adolescence and risk for turning to drugs to self-medicate. But the bottom line, as I've seen in my practice over the last 30, 35 years, is that very often when we look at adolescents at risk for substance abuse, they somehow elude either their families or their community's bumper sticker. They somehow don't fit the bumper sticker. We all know, as we were just talking in the earlier session about Shidduchim, we all know that families and communities have bumper stickers. What's the mission statement of your family? What's your own mission statement? You know, I heard recently about Michael Josephson, the head of the Center for Ethics, said, you have to get in touch with who you want to be. He said, imagine yourself after you're gone. You should live a long life, and after 120 years, you're hearing your hesped, you're hearing your eulogy. He said, imagine what they want, what you want people to say about you. What do you want your mission statement to be? What are the core points that you want your eulogizers to say about you, and then live life backwards? Very interesting kind of point. But families have those mission statements. Some families, the mission statement may be Ivy League or die. Others, it may be, Lakewood or Brisk or the Mir or else. Others, it may be Chesed or bust. But what happens when you have an adolescent who doesn't fit the bumper sticker of his or her family? You have an adolescent who has an attention deficit disorder and can't make it to have the incredible grades that you need in order to get into an Ivy League school, or doesn't have the focus to make it in a demanding yeshiva. This week's parsha, I hope, is the parsha with the famous statement of Rav Shamshi Rafal Hirsch on Jewish history. Rav Hirsch says the following. He's talking about Yaakov and Esav, and he says, you know something? He said, world history would have been different had Yitzchak sent Esav to a different school than he sent Yitzchak. Yaakov was somebody who was designed for studying nonstop, was designed for a yeshiva like Shem Be'Eder. Esav, on the other hand, was designed for a different kind of school. He was more of an active person. He was more of an impulsive person, maybe even at risk for substance abuse if we look at the risk factors of the slides I would have shown. Okay? That's what he said. He says, fascinatingly, he says, had he gone to the right kind of school, had his uniqueness been fostered, had the bumper sticker of the education that he had been expanded to fit that kind of temperament, he said, world history and Jewish history would have taken a whole different course. Fascinating. So take home message number one I want to leave you with, this is an obvious one, but it has to be said, is that we have to keep our eyes open. We have to be aware of what are the risk factors. When do we see a kid who somehow our protective shield has eluded our children? When do we have somebody who is somehow in our schools or in our family, somehow on the outs, because there might be a risk that they're going to be feel marginalized, they're going to find solace with equally marginalized peers, and some of them might self-medicate or just be drawn to the more deviant components that each of our communities has, because there they can get a sense of belonging, and substances might give them a sense of somehow solace. Very similar issues to the issues that were talked about earlier when we talked about eating disorders. So that's number one. Number two is the issue of monitoring. The issue of monitoring is the issue that is basically, the research shows very, very clearly that lack of supervision triples risk. Having a relationship with our children where we know what they're doing and we're on top of them, not in a way that smothers them, but where we find the balance between love and limits, when we have that, that's when we are much more likely to be able to hold them in a place where they're less likely to abuse substances. Study after study shows this. In terms of the summaries of the research, as I understand it, the key factor that will be protective is having parents who have a close relationship yet trust. As has been said, rules without relationships equals rebellion. If it's all limit setting, no relationship, kids are going to rebel. If it's all love with no limits, it's not good. There's a book that came out last year by Twenge called The Narcissism Epidemic, and he cites some fascinating studies that shows that every year from 1920 onward till today, there have been studies asking parents, what do you want most when you think about parenting your children? What's the top of your mattering map as you think about what it is that your dreams are for raising children? In the top three on people's mattering map from 1920 till about 1980 was raising obedient children. Top three. Every year from 1980 on, raising obedient children started to go down in prominence. And more recently, it doesn't even make it onto the list. It's just not there. Now what people value is more independence, it's self-concept, all incredibly, incredibly important protectors, as we'll hear. But the bottom line is that in order to have a really healthy child, we also need to have those kind of limits, and we have to find that balance. And that balance is what it's all about. Our rabbis tell us in the Talmud that the key to raising children is finding the balance between smol gofa v'yamin karevis, the left hand pushing away while the right hand brings closer. And Rabbi Simcha Wasserman, a brilliant educator in California in the last generation, said, what happens if you put into play what our rabbis tell us, and you push a child away with the left hand while bringing him simultaneously closer with the right hand? He says you turn them around. And that's what the research shows on prevention of substance abuse. Finding that balance, but finding that balance is an art, especially in a society that is not as comfortable with that left hand pushing away in the same way. There's an incredible medrash on a pasuk in Mishlei. The pasuk in Mishlei says, Yaser bincha kiyesh tikva vel hamisoel titei nafshecha. Put limits on your child, there's always hope. Don't pay attention to their screaming and yelling. And the medrash, which rings kind of strange to our Western ears, says, Kol hamosif av yisurim al bino, mosif ha-ben ahava al-aviv. Isn't that an amazing medrash? The more a father puts limits on his son, the more that son will love back the father.
It's true.
It's true, but it has to be done with balance. And let me end that section with a quick story from the same Rav Simcha Wasserman that I heard from one of his former students. One of his former students told me that he was a student in the high school, the Masifta High School, that Rabbi Wasserman was the Mashgiach of. And the rule there was is that before you went to the long day of learning both secular studies and Judaic studies, you had to make your bed. It was a dormitory high school. Now, as many of the parents here know, especially mothers, what adolescent in history, especially what adolescent male, has easily made his beds? So, of course, the boys never made their beds. One day, my friend told me, he comes back after a long day of learning, comes back from night seder, it's 10:30 at night, and he and his two roommates walk into the room and they don't know what happened, because all three beds are made meticulously, hospital corners, like unbelievably professionally made beds. And on each pillow, in meticulous handwriting, are five words. And here are the words: beds made by Simcha Wasserman. He said Rabbi Wasserman never gave them a dirty look, he never gave them a lecture, never said a word to them. He says, I got news for you. Rest of our high school career, our room was the room. All three of us, we made our beds beautifully every morning. Okay, that's the balance between love and limits, especially in a generation that's not so good in accepting limits, and we could learn from that. And let me just move to my final two points. One point is the point of clarity, and that's that the more clear we are about placing those limits, the research tell us, sort of surprisingly, adolescents want us to tell them where we stand. We shouldn't lecture, we shouldn't nag, we shouldn't bring them to the point of parent deafness because we say the same thing over and over again, but they want us to calmly be clear about how we feel about drinking, how we feel about drugs. And to just say, look, it's going to break our hearts if you do this. And to say it, well, I guess that sounds like a guilt-inducing thing, but to say it with clarity. There's something for clarity. All the research shows that if you wake an adolescent up in the middle of the night and you say, whose opinion do you value most, in spite of the fact that most adolescents act like they couldn't care less about what parents say. What's the name of that best-selling book? Mom, would you get out of my life, but first would you take me and Cheryl to the mall, right? There's that ambivalence. But nevertheless, our kids want limits. Quick vignette. Week before last, I spent a day in Los Angeles doing a number of meetings and lectures and ultimately a community talk on the internet. And to get ready for it, I asked some colleagues in Beverly Hills, Los Angeles, Debbie Fox and some of her colleagues, somebody who actually is a very close colleague of David and me in terms of this book we just put out on child abuse in the community, in the Orthodox community. So Debbie did a study where she surveyed adolescents going to modern Orthodox yeshivas in the Los Angeles area. And she surveyed hundreds of kids and came back on the internet with 180 responses. But to me, the most interesting question, the most interesting responses was to the following question. This is just a week and a half ago. Here's what she asked. She asked, when you are parents of adolescents, when you have your own teens at home, A, are you going to have rules about the internet? B, what will those rules be? And C, how will they be different from what your parents have? And most of the kids gave answers that shocked us. Most of the kids said, yeah, you know, we need our parents to tell us no. We need our parents to basically say no internet after 10:30 at night. We need our parents to put some limits on us. We see things that we wish we hadn't seen, and we waste our time in ways that we wish we didn't. We need this, and that's the way we're going to be different. I was shocked. And it's interesting, because at the talk I gave Thursday night before last in the Museum of Tolerance, they forced a bunch of kids to come. They actually, the kids in the 9th and 10th grades in the local yeshivas there had to come. And when I asked them, just by a show of hands, first of all, I asked them, how many of you can text with your hands in your pockets? 100% raised their hand. That's what we're dealing with. 100%. That just blew me away. But then when I asked them, how many of you would welcome a dialogue that would include rules on the internet? Pretty much most of them raised their hand. I was shocked. So that's the penultimate take-home message. is we need clarity. It's clearly in the research seen as a as an important component of prevention. Let me end with the final point and the final story. Well, two stories? I have two quick stories. Am I okay, David? Yes? Okay. Okay. Robert Torsky. Okay, let me here's the two quick story number one, it's about modeling. And modeling is often invisible. We don't even realize we do. So story number one is a great story. And it goes like this. It's the OU bans kiddish clubs. What was it, about 5 years ago? They banned kiddish clubs. And Rabbi Kripke, who was the leader of the ban back then, comes to work that Monday morning and tells me that he comes to work and an angry phone call is waiting for him. The president of one of the larger OU shuls saying, "Rabbi, I can't believe it. This religion has very little joy for me and my member, the men in my shul. And here, the one thing we really enjoy in the religion is kiddush club. And you take that away, 10 minutes of joy in Jewish men's life, you take that away." Now, that leads to spirituality. One of Rabbi Tversky's most recent books, in the 60-plus books that he's published, David, it's up to 61, 62, something like that, is on spirituality. And the connection between spirituality and prevention of substance abuse is incredibly powerful, incredibly important. And that's a talk in itself. But the president says, "You're taking away our joy." Okay? Because that, for him, was his spirituality. Sad. To find it in a little cup of single malt scotch. And Robert Kripke says, "Listen, we had to do it. It's a risk for adolescents. They're telling us that they're getting into drinking because of what they see their fathers do. Shabbos morning before Musaf, when they walk out, they come back for Musaf drunk, the rabbi's speech drunk. What kind of message is that for kids?" President hangs up the phone on Rabbi Kripke. 2 weeks later, Rabbi Kripke comes back to his office, and there's a phone call from the same shul president, saying, "Rabbi Kripke, I'm calling to apologize and to tell you I'm banning kiddush club in my shul." He said, "Thursday night, I took my son to the garden to watch the Knicks lose, okay? And I had my 15-year-old son with me, and we were having a great time. There was a group of college kids who had smuggled some beer into the garden. And they were drinking nonstop. And they were really out of their minds drunk. So I figure it's a teachable moment. So I nudge my kid. I say, "Look, you know, you see what fools these kids look like when they're drinking like this?" He says, "You have to just be careful about the way you handle alcohol." So the kid looks at his father and he says, "Yeah, but it's exactly the way you and your friends look every Shabbos morning when you come back from kiddush." Okay? And that's it. Yaakov Kamenetsky used to say that parents aren't mechanchem, they're mashpiyim. What's a mashpia? A mashpia, he says, comes from the word shipushep. It's a ramp. It's a ramp. Okay? It's what we ramp down without even knowing it. So with this, I'll end. Just sort of, again, the four take-home messages is to just quickly review is that we have to keep our eyes open, even though it may be hard to see, to that knowledge about the risk when our kids aren't reaching our bumper stickers. We have to expand our bumper stickers. We have to be open to the need to overcome this societal tendency to specialize in love and not limits, and to be comfortable with putting limits because kids want it. We have to be careful about clarity and making incredibly clear in as soft but clear way as possible what we expect from our children in terms of this. And ultimately, we have to be aware of the invisible lessons of Shikua, while at the same time opening ourselves up to the need for reaching each child's soul based on their unique needs. Thank you.
Very much, David. Dr. Polkowitz. Setting limits was an emphasis that Dr. Polkowitz mentioned a number of times. There's a really fantastic book, less than 100 pages, by Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, Planting and Raising a Jewish Child. It's a must-read for everyone. And it certainly must be for anyone that's working in this field of mental health on any issue, including addictions. While it does not discuss addiction specifically, its central theme is on setting limits. Dr. Pelkowitz mentioned it, and it's been said many times, that leadership is not what you accomplish in the organization that you're in while you were there. It's whether or not they're still following the thoughts 5, 10, 20, 50, 100 years, 1,000 years after you've left. Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky has a most impressive bio. The most impressive part of his bio is that people are still and will continue to speak about, to learn from, to implement so many things that he's taught us over the years, and God willing, for many years to come. Not only from the 60 books, not only from the scores of articles, not from the hundreds of lectures, but from the one or two provocative moments that we have heard him speak about over the past 5, 10, 20 years when other people did not speak about these issues. With that, it's a real privilege. Bye-bye, Dr. Abraham Twersky.
Thank you so much, David. I will go to a very circumscribed topic to talk about the halachic aspects of alcohol and drugs. Not too much to say about that. Here are two volumes written about shitia, the shitrus b'halacha, drinking and drunkenness in halacha. And as you go through the table of contents, there are many subjects, like at what stage can a person who's been drinking, is he permitted to daven? What about a shochet who drinks? What are the criteria of responsibility according to drinking? What about somebody who drank on the day that he was married, right? Does drink compromise his competency for gitmin and kedushin? Many subjects can be talked about alcoholism and halacha, but they're not practical, and that these are not things that we are going to deal with. And when it comes down to things that we're going to deal with, that they are actually very narrow, and I can probably do it all in 5 minutes. So I cannot resist the temptation to deviate a little bit from the topic and elaborate on something that Dr. Pelkowitz had said when he had pointed out the enormous importance of disciplining children by small docha v'yamin mikarevos, of disciplining and distancing and being strict and yet bringing closer with love. And the reason I have to tell you this is just because I have an opportunity to do so, and it's my favorite story. And so probably 90% of you know it, and so you can hear it again. As a child, I was, at age 9, a chess champion. No one could beat me. And one Rosh Hashanah, there was a very fine rabbi from Chicago who was our guest for Yom Tov. And on Rosh Hashanah afternoon, he says to me, "You want to play chess?" I said, "It's Yom Tov." He says, "So why can't you play chess on Yom Tov? What's wrong with it?" "Oh, okay." So I played, had him two games of chess, and I beat him both times. Second night of Rosh Hashanah, the Shamus comes over, and he tells me, "The rabbi wants to see you in the study." Okay, so I came in, and my father was looking into a sefer, and he let me stand there. And you know, the discipline at that time was not that you'd come in and say, "What do you want, Dad?" No. You sit there and you wait until you're recognized. So he let me stand there while looking into a sefer, and then he looked up at me. "You played chess on Rosh Hashanah?" I said, "Yes, Rabbi so-and-so said you're allowed to." He did not say a word, but he looked back into the section, and almost imperceptibly, but just enough that I could detect it, shook his head. That was the extent of it. He didn't say a word, just a tiny little shaking of the head. And I got the message, even at the age of 9. The rabbi was right. Technically, it's permissible. But you should understand that Rosh Hashanah is not a day for games. Let's say, so I got the message. Well, I couldn't leave because I hadn't been dismissed. So I had to wait until my father said, "Geh gesundheit." So I stood there. And he looked into his sefer, and a few minutes later he looked up at me. "You beat him?" I said, "Yeah, twice. Geh gesundheit." That is such a beautiful example of delivering the message to discipline, but not letting me walk out feeling negative about myself. Right? So, I don't play chess on Shabbos and Yom Tov ever since then. There are actually only a few practical issues to talk about alcohol. However, there is one thing that I believe is extremely important to know, and that is that we are living today in the year 2010. And we have to deal with today's reality. Just a few weeks ago, we learned about Noach, who the Torah tells us was a perfect tzaddik, tzaddik tamim. And then this perfect tzaddik goes out and gets drunk. And the Sfas-Emes asks, how does a person who's a perfect tzaddik get drunk? And his answer is extremely important. He says, Noach knew how much he could drink without being intoxicated or negatively affected. That was before the flood. And after he came out of the Teva, after the flood, he went back to using the same amount that he knew was safe. What he did not realize, it was not the same world anymore. The world had changed. And when the world changes, the rules change. It's extremely important. The kind of tolerance that there had been for drinking in the past cannot be dealt with today. It's a different world. Particularly, the halacha of drinking on Purim, which seems to be a clear-cut halacha from the Talmud into the Shulchan Aruch that one must drink until one does not distinguish between Baruch Mordechai and Baruch Haman. And incidentally, 99% of the people don't read it correctly. They think, oh, you got to be so intoxicated that you shouldn't know whether you're blessing Mordechai or cursing him or blessing Mordechai. It's not what it says. It says not to know the difference between blessing Mordechai and cursing Haman. Now, the Talmud says that when the tzaddik is elevated, the rasha descends. Well, if the rasha descends, the tzaddik is elevated. Therefore, if Mordechai is blessed, Haman is cursed. If Haman is cursed, Mordechai is blessed. So what's the difference? What's the difference whether you approach it by blessing Mordechai or by blessing Haman, or by cursing Haman? What is the difference? And so I challenge people, tell me what's the difference when you're stone sober. And if you can't tell me the difference when you're sober, what business have drinking? So it's a totally misinterpretation of the Talmud Mishnah. However, let's grant that someone wants to interpret that it means to drink to intoxication. Right? And they quote the Gemara, and it's a tremendous mitzvah. Well, we don't pass Gishalas from the Gemara. And we don't even pass Gishalas from the Shulchan Aruch. We have posting after that, and virtually the final posting is the Chofetz Chaim in the Mishnah Berurah. Right? Very, very reliable. So the Chofetz Chaim, as far as drinking as Purim, quotes the Ramah, where the Ramah says that one need not become intoxicated, that one just drinks a tiny bit more than one usually does, and then goes to sleep. And takes a nap, and then he doesn't know for Mordechai or Haman. And the Chofetz Chaim says, this is what you should do. Now, the Chofetz Chaim knew the Talmud as well as anyone else. And when the Chofetz Chaim says, this is what you should do, that is the halacha for our age. And anyone who wants to be more machmir than the Chofetz Chaim, I say, kol hakavod, start off with Lashon Hara. When you want to be more machmir than the Chofetz Chaim or Lashon Hara, then you can be more machmir here. The reason why this is so important is that in an age where alcoholism and drug addiction is so prominent, and the disasters are so great, right? It's like Noach after the Teva. It's a different age, and we have to prevent our youth from seeing that intoxication is permissible under any circumstances, let alone a simple Teva, where there is nothing anywhere that condones excessive drinking on simple Teva. Nor is that appropriate to see young people at weddings drink excessively. And these are things that should be absolutely forbidden. And I go so far to say that when you come to a Shalom Zochar, and it's traditional that you have Nahid Arbus and beer, and you serve a glass of beer, fine, but not to a youngster. And anybody who gives a minor drink, I'm not talking about the legal aspect, but I believe the halachic aspect, anybody who gives a minor drink other than the tiny bit of wine for kiddush, which is permissible, but to give them beer to Shalom Zochot is only for a beraisa of lifnei evelus initial. Maybe it's not a beraisa, maybe it's a rabbono. Right? But it is putting a stumbling block before a blind person and is causing harm to an individual. And I think that today, because of the way things are with youth, we have to, and you know what it's like on the college scene, that hardly a month goes by where you don't find a case of an alcohol death due to the fraternity drinking. So in an age where this goes on, we have to really take a very close look at discipline and a very close look at how do we model for our children. And I'm so glad that Dr. Pelker was referred to the problem of kiddush clubs. Yes, it's perfectly legitimate to make kiddush on al chayim, no problem with that. But that is not excessive drinking. But on the other hand, if you take a look at a kiddush, and you know what to do, go down to the shul social hall after people leave, right? And then see how many kids, youngsters, going around looking for the little glasses with the tiny little bit of whiskey left over, right? So these are the kinds of things that we have to be extremely careful for. So the problem of excessive drinking on Purim is a halachic problem, and I made my point clear on that. I don't think it should be allowed, and I think that people in prominent positions who drink to excess are setting a terrible example for their children and their students and their followers. The other point that I think is important from halacha is in terms of treatment of alcoholism. Now, that's a whole subject that I could talk about not for 5 minutes, but for 5 hours, about the treatment of alcoholism, the treatment of any addiction, where I believe that in addition to psychotherapy, you have to have the support of people who have been there and who know what to do and what not to do. I have been involved in treatment of over 40,000 alcoholics. 40,000. I will never undertake personal treatment of an alcoholic. Because if he calls me up at 2:30 in the morning and he wants to know what he should do because he has the urge to take a drink, I have no idea what to tell him. I never needed a drink at 2:30 in the morning. He has to have a list of 7 or 8 people who can call, who know what it's like to have a compulsion at 2:30 in the morning. And this is why the support groups of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous and the other 12-step programs, Overeaters Anonymous and all the others, are so tremendously important. And by the way, a little bit of a commercial. There is a good explanation of the 12 steps on this week's Dvar Torah on TorahWeb.org. TorahWeb.org. It's Musar and the 12 Steps. But anyway, a alcoholic who is clean, sober. A week, a year, 5 years, still may have the compulsion to drink. And all that is necessary is for one drink to send him off into a drunken spree. And we don't understand exactly the physiology of that, but that's what happens practically. So Friday night he has the surge. He made kiddush on grape juice. Right? But now the house is quiet. It's 2:30 in the morning. Right? And he has his compulsive drink. What does he do? Well, normally he would call his sponsor. But it's Friday night. Is he allowed to call his sponsor? That is a clear halacha b'kashya. And I'm not going to give you the answer. I say you must ask a posek. But you better ask a posek who understands what alcoholism is about. Because a posek who has no idea what is alcoholism about is not competent to answer the question. Experience that I've had with one posek felt that yes, it is pikuach nefesh, because if he starts getting into the drunken spree, any kind of things can happen, and that he is permitted to call. However, he suggested that the alcoholic avail himself of the kinds of telephones that doctors have, which are so constructed to minimize the diagnosis, to eliminate the diagnosis and make it the abonos, to make it a lesser violation of Shabbos. Can the alcoholic or drug addict go to an AA meeting Friday night? Well, if he can walk there, I don't see much of a problem. If it means that he can't get there without without transportation, then what? Again, this child has to ask a child. And I can't give you a tell on that, but I say one cannot say Chas v'Sholem it's Shabbos. I think one has to ask a shaila and not make a pesach halacha by himself. Yes, there have been cases where a posek has said that if the driver is not a Jew and if the someone else opens the door so that the light doesn't go on, etc., under some circumstances, he permitted them to drive. But that's not a pesach halacha for everyone. And I think that every individual must ask their own posek, but again, have a posek who knows what the condition is, and he knows what one drink can do, or what one drug can do. So, halachas are there, and we have to have our posek to deal with. What's the status of a woman who's married to an alcoholic and she cannot tolerate his drinking, right? And so she's asking for a divorce? Can Bez then compel the husband, assuming that he would listen, to give, is that grounds for divorce? There again, that's halacha to Gishayla. And again, you have to know, what do you mean he's an alcoholic? Is he an alcoholic who has never been treated and is amenable to treatment? I was at the airport in Chicago, and a couple comes over to me. You, Dr. Tversky? I said, yes. I was in Gateway, that was my rehabilitation center. I was in Gateway 8 years ago, and now we are on our way to Hawaii to celebrate our 25th anniversary. And without Gateway, there never would have been a 25th anniversary. So here's a person who was an alcoholic who accepted treatment, got his life together, got his act together, and is sober and is happy. However, there are other situations where the person has been in four rehabs and does not follow through and does not appear motivated, and the wife says, I can't take it anymore. So there it's a question of, can Bezin order him to give the gift? Again, it's halacha b'kashya, but the posek, the Rov must know what the circumstances are, what the likelihood is of this person, can he get sober? Is that should now simply to make shalom bias without knowing what is going on can be a mistake. So in each situation, one has to know the circumstances, one has to know the facts. The question of a person who drives drunk and is arrested for drunk driving. Or Chassid Shalom has an accident and injures somebody. What is the halachic attitude toward that person? Should one try to extract that person from the consequences of his drunk driving. Now, my old position is I regularly used to get calls from lawyers. Dr. Tversky, I'm an attorney and I have a client, and I'd like to get your expertise. I'm looking for an expert witness. I say, well, what's the problem? Well, my client was arrested for drunk driving. I said, I will testify for the prosecution. So they stopped calling me. I think it's a serious mistake to take away the punitive consequences of drunk driving. And to try and get, quote, lenience, right, and to bring in a chesed, a rachman, whatever, is a serious mistake. Drunk drivers have to be dealt with to the extent of the law, I believe it's a mistake to extricate themselves from the consequences. I do want to say one word about the theme that Dr. Pelko spoke about, and that is prevention. Okay, I think that we're missing one tremendous point. Right. Back in President Reagan's administration, Nancy Reagan launched a program, Just Say No to Drugs. Oh, we had a gala time with that, you know? We say, now she's going to deal with the problem of homelessness by saying, just build a house. Just say no to drugs. Anyway, some social workers did a little bit of a research project, and they went around asking young people, what do you think of this, just say no to drugs? And one 14-year-old young woman said, why? Why? What else is there? And that is a powerful statement. And I believe that many youngsters get into alcoholism and to drugs because they don't have an answer to what else is there. The gentleman who found 10 minutes of joy in religion from drinking, right? These youngsters are looking for several minutes of happiness, right? Because they don't get it from elsewhere. And the question is, how do we provide a background of happiness for our children? How do we provide a background of Yiras Shamayim for our children? Now, alcohol and drug addiction are tremendously important, and they're rampant. There's right now an epidemic that is competing with alcoholism and drug addiction for its destructiveness, and that's internet pornography. And internet pornography, there is no immunity, and you have some of the finest people, Talmidei Chachamim, etc., etc. And the idea we're going to do away with the internet is a fantasy. We're not going to do away with the internet. You can find filters, whatever. But the statement was made so beautifully by Avraham Avinu when Avimelech said, hey, why did you do this to me? Why did you say that Sarah was your sister? And he said, Rak ein yiras elokim b'mokem hazeh. No matter how sophisticated you are, there is no yiras shamayim here. When there's no yiras shamayim, anything can happen. I think we have to take a good look at what kind of yiras shamayim we have in our homes. No, I know we have God kosher, right? And we have pas yisol and chodosh and avodah. But there is one powerful statement from Chaim Vital, and no one else of lesser stature could have made that. The Chaim Vital is successor to the Arizal, who says a person should exert greater caution with the observance of his midos than with mitzvahs or avodos. So, pas yisol, chodosh, chol yisol, all important, right? But we must take at least as great caution with our midos of chaos. I believe that any person who loses his temper in the household, for whatever reason, is making a serious impression on his children, which is against Torah, against Yiras Shamayim. And so, if we develop our life with true midos, and Mesilas Yeshua, Mithna Meliyahu, Oakhurst, I think, and all of the wonderful Mr. Thorne, and actively live them, not teach them, but model them. Then I think that we can build up a kind of Yiddish Shemayim in our children where they will naturally avoid the kind of things that are destructive and anathema to Yiddish Shemayim. Thank you for listening.
Rabbi Dr. Tversky answers a phone call from an individual at 2:30 in the morning seeking advice on how to deal with alcoholism, and he says, I'm not the one to answer your question. Is there a better message on halacha and ethics in terms of knowing what to do and what one's limits are as a mental health professional in working with individuals? Let's take a couple of questions. If you want to tell us who you're directing it to, please also. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Cheryl Miller. This is directed to Rabbi Dr. Tversky. In terms of substance abuse in adolescence, a lot of it may be due to peer pressure, which then goes back to self-esteem. And when you're with your peers at school and it's hard to say no, I think a lot of that goes back to the self-esteem in the child, in the home. Can you comment on that?
I'm not sure I got the question, but I heard something.
Okay, the idea of peer pressure. Obviously, peer pressure is important. Okay? And youngsters spend perhaps more time with their peers than they do with their parents. But I must tell you just one anecdote. A number of years ago, I was called into an emergency meeting. This was a meeting at which the representatives of all of the Haredi communities came. And the yeshivas, the Hasidic groups. And they talked about the fact that we're losing our kids. And so one person got up and he said, so what do you think? When I was in yeshiva, you think there were no bombs around then? Sure there were bombs around then. He said, but I didn't associate with them because I didn't want to lose my parents. He says, today's children are in a situation where they don't have parents to lose. He says, the father comes home from work and it's 8:30 at night. Right? So here he's got a beeper and here he's got a cell phone. And he's talking out of the telephone, and the youngster comes over to talk to him, and he says, Tati, what are you talking to me for? Can't you see I'm busy now? I'm afraid that there's some truth to that. That, unfortunately, sometimes because the responsibilities of caring for the family financially are so great, that we don't have time to parent our children properly. Because, yes, peer pressure is great, but parental respect should be able to overcome that. And if it doesn't, then we have to look as to how we can strengthen the parental pressure to withstand the peer pressure.
Any other questions? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Zero tolerance for alcohol for any adolescent? At any point, at any time?
The question is, do you support, what's your comment on zero tolerance for adolescents? Of any alcohol.
Question of.
You want to clarify that question?
Question of zero tolerance. First of all, you don't want to do anything that you can't observe, right? Zero tolerance for alcohol, I don't believe is necessary. I think it's perfectly legitimate to make Kiddush on wine. And use the shear, the proper shear of wine, right? For grown-ups who want to have a l'chaim after the fish, yeah, that's also legitimate, right? But show control. Very interesting thing. Talk about zero tolerance. The greatest incidents of alcohol, of children who become alcoholics, are either from parents who are alcoholic or parents who are teetotalers. Because parents who never drank in a controlled fashion never demonstrate the ability to control alcohol. So I think that zero tolerance can backfire. What we have to do is show responsible drinking. And Kiddush clubs, the problem with them was that was irresponsible drinking. Right? But the Kiddush with the Lachaim, no problem.